From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how 2,000 Mules is a complete fake documentary about voter fraud, but will Texas leaders admit that? And Juneteenth Rodeo, why 1970s photos of a black rodeo were ignored for so long. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Salem Media Group, a Texas-based right-wing multimedia company, has stopped distributing its film 2,000 Mules, which was spreading conspiracies about the 2020 election being stolen. 2,000 Mules was written and directed by right-wing political commentator Dinesh D'Souza, and it presents disinformation and a false narrative about alleged ballot fraud. The film on its face is clearly not factual, but it's been promoted by former President Donald Trump. The convicted felon held a screening at his Florida country club, and top Texas Republicans have been promoting the debunked film, citing it as proof that the election was stolen. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton's office, which oversees investigations into voter fraud, screened the movie, and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick sponsored a watch party at a Houston area church. Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller pointed to the film when asked about his belief in the stolen election on the Texas Standard.
And do you agree with Trump's claim that the 2020 election was stolen from him?
I believe it was. We have evidence of that. We have the video of the 2,000 Mules. We have evidence up in Dallas, even from the election before that.
Here's how comedian John Oliver explained some of the problems with 2,000 Mules on his program last week tonight.
Person picking up ballots and running them to the drop boxes.
This is not grandma out walking her dog. Bad backgrounds, bad reputation.
The central idea of this movie is the claim that there were vote mules who repeatedly visited ballot boxes and deposited suspect ballots, and that Dinesh and his friends have identified them using cell phone data. And it would take the rest of this show to debunk the movie's claims point by point. But very quickly, there is no way by just using cell phone data to know whether someone visited a drop box or was just in the vicinity of one, particularly since those boxes were installed in high traffic areas. Meanwhile, the only map that seems to show someone driving around dumping ballots is fake, and another map supposedly showing a drop box site is actually a stock photo of Moscow, with a third one just the same Moscow map again, but rotated 90 degrees.
So now, Salem Media Group, which helped produce and distribute the film, is releasing a public apology. It's also disavowed the book and the film and withdrew them from distribution. Because they're admitting it's entirely false and there's no evidence to support their claims. So what about the Texas political leaders who have been promoting this fake message? Will they apologize? I spoke to Jessica Hoosman, editorial director of VoteBeat.
I think they do. I think that that has been imperative for quite a long time. I don't think that there is any specific indication that they're going to. And I think that it is particularly interesting to note that Brandon Gill, who just won his primary in Texas's 26th congressional district and will almost certainly be sent to Congress in November, is Dinesh D'Souza's son-in-law, and his political claim to fame is setting up a website to defend 2,000 Mules. So not only are we not having people retract these statements, we are having people who are aggressively doubling down on them being elevated to our nation's highest offices.
So that kind of illustrates the problem that the system allows people like Dinesh D'Souza to create this manufactured documentary and lie, and it gains traction and currency and does damage to our democracy. And then when it becomes so badly apparent that this is complete and total, you know, invention, a fabrication, it's too late.
It is too late. And I think that, you know, this is evidence of something that I think has become more true in America, which is that a lot of times we are not getting to the truth. until that truth can be worked through a court of law. And that's basically what happened here, right? The Atlanta man who was actually called a criminal in the 2000 Mules documentary sued for defamation. He sued the distribution company, he sued True the Vote, and he sued Dinesh D'Souza. The only person admitting any fault here and apologizing for their work in this documentary was Salem, right? Was the distributor. And so I think it's important to note that two of the three people involved in this lawsuit are continuing to litigate it.
So Salem says they pulled distribution of the book and of the video, and also they issued an apology. But I guess all the other settlement part of the case will not be made public.
No, as far as I know, that will remain a private matter. And then also his case against True the Vote and Dinesh D'Souza is ongoing. So we'll see how that resolves itself. True the Vote is currently involved in multiple other lawsuits across the country for various things, including another defamation case. So, you know, I think that ultimately every actor in this will face some kind of, you know, responsibility for what they've done. But I think that is often after they've been allowed to profit from it in a really substantial way.
Yeah, the video made over $1 million. But the question about the comeuppance is, will it come too late?
Right. And I think that's an unknown question. Right. In 2022, we certainly saw people taking 2000 Mules to heart and taking it upon themselves to, while often armed, guard drop boxes. A lot of states crack down on that through the courts or the legislature. So I guess we'll see if that happens again. The people who made this documentary, Dinesh D'Souza and True the Vote, are continuing to profit off of it. Dinesh D'Souza is still selling it on Amazon. And they say that they're going to stand by it. So, you know, I think that it will probably continue to hold water at least until this case works its way through the courts.
Jessica Huseman is the editorial director of Vote Beat. During the 1970s, Texas photojournalist Sarah Byrd found herself captivated by non-mainstream rodeos. She documented a variety of the competitions for many years, and she said she really fell in love with black rodeos and documented them with her photography, but she couldn't find any outlets willing to publish her work. Now, decades later, these images are finding an audience in a new book, Juneteenth Rodeo, published by University of Texas Press. I spoke to Sarah Byrd about this journey.
I was doing photojournalism at the University of Texas, and I relative newcomer to Texas, and so I fell in love with all the oddities the state has to offer, and, you know, blessed University of Texas stuck a camera in my hands, and at that point, this is the time before everybody went around with the equivalent of a dark room and a photo studio in their back pocket, you know, that could also make phone calls occasionally if you wanted to do that. But these were the days when photography was expensive and it was arduous. And fortunately, the University of Texas, you know, allowed me to do that. So I went out and I photographed all these bizarre things that I've fallen in love with in Texas. I photographed sorority rushes and honky tonk dance halls and rattlesnake roundup. But mostly I photographed the rodeos, and I just fell under the spell of rodeo, not necessarily what happened in the arena. I'm not a super sports fan. And, you know, as an animal lover, you know, maybe not thrilled about everything that happened in the arena, but everything around the arena just fascinated me. It was like how all these different groups I photographed police, prison, kids, chariadas, girls rodeo, old timers rodeos. I photographed them all. Heard of a nudist rodeo in California, of course, but Never got close enough to that one to learn the true meaning of bareback riding, to say nothing of raw hide. But, you know, so I had this kind of basis of comparison, and that I'd been to all these other rodeos. And then I was lucky enough to come upon Black rodeos, and it was night and day. It was this wonderful, exuberant, vibrant, very, very community-oriented experience. And I fell in love. I just fell in love with particularly the Black rodeos. And you know, I bring my photographs back to, you know, show my pals at the university. And, you know, these are kids who had grown up in Texas. And more than once, someone said, huh, I didn't know there were Black cowboys. And they did not say it in any kind of mean way, just slightly perplexed and like, huh, I didn't know that there were Italian leprechauns, just something they had not encountered before. So at that point, I realized that I had something special, that this was a story that had not been told, and these were images that had not been seen. So I, you know, put together what little money I had and traveled to all these tiny Texas towns where these community rodeos were held, you know, Plum, Egypt, El Campo, Kendleton, Pin Oak. And then I began submitting to publishers and got many, many rejections in various forms. They said that there is no audience for this, there's no interest. So that was the late 70s, early 80s, you know, fast forward to 2024, I've lost track. And obviously there's a tremendous amount of interest in Black cowboys and Black ranching culture, Black cowgirls. So, you know, the time was right.
The reaction that I didn't know there were Black cowboys because popular media
correct
didn't tell us about Black cowboys. The only film that had a Black cowboy in it would have been Mel Brooks.
That's right. Blazing Saddles, also in The Searchers. But, you know, it was an anomaly. It was an anomaly. And, you know, people in large part don't see what they're not trained to see. And so by and large, in the South, Black cowboys were not seen and certainly not welcome at white rodeos.
Yeah, the rodeos were segregated, but during the time of the great cattle drives in Texas post-Civil War, one in four cowboys or cowhands were cowboys.
That's right.
And the term cowboy was actually meant just for a Black cowhand.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. And all the great Southern plantations were worked by Black cowhands before the Civil War. So long, long heritage.
And so when you would go to cover these rodeos, the Black rodeos, because there was segregated, had the segregation was still in place, and this was just, you know, there had become a heritage and a culture of Black rodeos, or was it?
It was officially, you know, the law was a desegregation, observed much more in the breach than in reality. So the reality of it was that Blacks were either straight out not allowed, or if they were able to enter a white rodeo, they would have to ride during what was called the slack. That was the time before the audience showed up. And, you know, barring all that, they were made to feel extremely unwelcome. And there was a lot of prejudice among the judges, among the white judges. So it was very, very difficult for Black rodeo contestants, you know, virtually impossible, all that combined with economic factors that worked against them. So these wonderful community affairs took the place in a lot of ways. And, you know, it's hard not to think that some of the, you know, the limitations that were imposed upon them and the pressures of that time somehow created these remarkable events. Remarkable, remarkable events where The emphasis was more on community than competition, and it was, the real grand prize was fun and friendship, and that's what you saw in abundance at those events.
Doing rodeo is a dangerous sport. We have people even today even having fatalities. I mean, you
Of
would
course,
hate
yeah.
to if you couldn't trust the people around you helping you getting ready to be in the chute and head out there with a bronco or bull. I mean, yeah, it would you definitely you have to trust the people around you. You wouldn't want to do that.
Correct. Yes. Very good point.
The photographs that you have, you do see so much joy and exuberance. People having that sense, strong sense of community. Were the rodeos that that you covered, the Black rodeos, the Juneteenth rodeo, were they small affairs, or how did that work out?
Yeah, all the ones that I visited were small. They were not all Juneteenth. The conceit of the book is that it takes place at one typical, although there were no typical Juneteenth rodeos, but it's a composite of events that I attended over many years, and but I arranged it so to make the reader feel as if they're spending a day at a Black rodeo from the moment you arrive, and you're greeted by the smell of barbecue because the pit master was always the first person to show up, and so that really contributed to the party vibe. And then, not the typical mournful country and Western music playing over the loudspeakers, but Boogie Fever. I have a photograph of a chute man with a Jackson 5 on the back of his shirt. Everything about it was so unique and wonderful.
We have to acknowledge the fact that I'm not African American. You're not African American. Here we are talking about Black rodeo. How do we make sense of that?
Well, I reflected on that quite a bit when I was going to these events because it was just remarkable to me how kind and hospitable everybody was. And then, I just could not help but thinking how unwelcome a Black person would have been at white rodeos at that time. That is not true by and large any longer, although rodeo remains one of the most out of proportion sports there is. That's true. I was just very, I just feel very fortunate, and I feel a very strong obligation to return these photographs to the communities that created such vibrant events, and also to identify as many of my subjects as I can so that they can receive the honor they deserve.
So, what was the Soul Circuit?
It was essentially an area within probably about 150-mile radius of Houston on the Gulf Coast, and that's where these rodeos, all the rodeos that I attended, were held within that area.
It's, so bringing these photos out today, and just to, that's part of the arc of the story that originally. When you had taken the photographs and you said, hey, these are really, there's something here. And then you were told by editors, oh, there's no market for this.
Right.
Now there is. What's
Correct.
changed?
There's a huge movement, has been for the last few years, to reclaim the history and heritage of Blacks in the West. Just a recognition of what was always there. And it's continued. There are now a lot of there's a lot of documentation of the current contemporary Black rodeo scene. Most notably, the Bill Pickett Invitational Circuit, which a wonderful photographer, Ivan McClellan, has taken a lot of photographs of that world. And it's there's been a spate of articles on the topic of, in The Guardian, for example, had an article. It's like, hey, the U.S. just discovered that there were Black cowboys that have always been there. So it's just part of this movement, and the overdue recognition to African Americans and their contributions to the West.
The photographs having been in the drawer for so long, now you bring them out and they're being shown and they're in this book, the people who were in the photographs, have you spoken to them and said, hey, you know, here you were back in your prime, man, and now.
Yeah, no, so, you know, fortunately, the negatives and the prints were all preserved and they're in good shape. Unfortunately, my notes did not survive our many moves, and many times the garage got flooded. So I knew, I mean, I remembered a lot of the identities of my subjects, but then I went on this big drive to find out the identities of as many of the Ropers, writers, and fans as I could. And so I started posting photos on social media. I didn't have a lot of hope because, you know, everyone in the rodeos would be the same age as me, you know, well into their 70s. And so I wasn't certain whether they'd be on social media or not, or even still with us. I was really just thrilled that so many sons and daughters or nieces and nephews called to say, "Hey, that's my dad, that's my mom, that's my aunt, that's." And so I got a lot of identities that way. And then I spoke with Larry Callis, who gave me the incredible news that in my photographs I had the great Mertis Dykman, called the Jackie Robinson of Black Rodeo. He wasn't there competing. I was on his way to going to the National Finals Rodeo 3 times, the first Black cowboy to break the color barrier in professional rodeo. And he was there just helping out behind the chutes and there for the fun and the fellowship and a wonderfully gracious human being. I didn't realize who that was. I also learned to my great delight that I had photographed a cowboy who went by his rodeo name was Bailey's Prairie Kid. This is the great Taylor Hall Jr., who adopted the name because he was born in the community of Bailey's Prairie. So he called himself Bailey's Prairie Kid. And I was lucky enough to photograph him on some of his last prize-winning rides before he retired. He is now 92. He's still with us, thank God. And he was the founder of a trail, very famous trail ride out of Prairie View, still leading that. But it was just a thrill. And then I actually heard from a couple of my subjects and who could have said, "Hey, that's me in that photograph." And so that was just very, very exciting process for me. It's an ongoing process. The Humanities Texas gave me a grant to produce a traveling show. So the photographs are, which I'm thrilled about, are going to be go to smaller communities. And it's an ongoing process. I've put a note on the exhibition that anybody who recognizes anyone in the photographs who are not named, I ask them to please get in touch with me. So hopefully, who knows, I might end up identifying everybody, especially some of the young buckaroos that are in the pictures.
Sarah Bird is a best-selling author. Her new book is a collection of photos from the 1970s Black Rodeos. It's called Juneteenth Rodeo, published by the University of Texas Press. The word maverick gets tossed around a lot. It's been used as the names of fictional characters to denote their independence or rebellious nature. For example, the Tom Cruise character of Maverick in the movie Top Gun. Actor James Gardner embodied the Maverick idea in his role as Brett Maverick in the old Western TV show Maverick. But there was a real Maverick who was known for being a political wild card from San Antonio during the 1930s. Some found sound of an archive radio show gives us a listen to how Maury Maverick was a national celebrity in the heyday of radio.
Information, please. Presented each week at this time by Canada Drive.
From 1938 to 1951, Information, Please was a popular radio quiz show where listeners mailed in questions to try to stump a panel of experts. Guest panelists often included celebrities. And on July 25th, 1938, here's how the host, literary critic Clifton Fadiman, introduced their guest expert.
And our guest of honor is an expert on a great many things, including the fine old tradition of American liberty. Formerly a member of Congress in Texas, he is now the hard-hitting mayor of San Antonio. I introduce to you the author of In Blood and Ink and the bearer of a name famous in the history of the Southwest, Maury Maverick.
I think these people are trying to frame me, the country boy coming to New York City.
I thought it was very interesting as a sort of as an artifact.
Louis Fisher is a historian and author of Maverick, the American name that became a legend. He says this old radio recording shows a different side of Maverick.
He's thought of a lot of times as a lot more bombastic than that. Now, I suppose he could be when he was giving political speeches. And in this show, he was more laid back, almost a genteel banterer, which is not the sort of image usually associated with him.
On the air, Maverick was asked about his famous family name.
Maverick. You want me to tell the story right? Well, I'll tell it for you.
Yeah, tell it right, but tell it short. Mr.
Okay. My grandfather was named Samuel A. Maverick. He took in 453 head of cattle, and they were in the hands of a colored slave, and he wouldn't brand them, so they called him Maverick's Cattle, and that's all he is to it. He never was a cattleman, like people say. And also, there's another thing. He only branded his own cattle. Some people say that he branded everybody's cattle, but he only branded his own.
And Maverick was quizzed about his knowledge of politics.
Now, since the Civil War, have there been any Democratic presidents who received a majority of the popular vote, a majority? And if so, who? You have to, Mr. Maverick? Franklin D. Roosevelt, and any other?
I don't think so.
Right. Absolutely right.
That would have been an easy question for Maverick. During his two terms in Congress, he was an ardent champion of Roosevelt's New Deal.
Sometimes even to the left of Roosevelt.
Fisher said Maverick was a novelty for the New York-based radio show, and he was known for more than just his name.
He was a fairly sought-after speaker, which took him all across the country. He spoke on a lot of liberal subjects, civil liberties. He was the only Southern congressman who voted for the anti-lynching law.
But Fisher said Maverick showed on the air that he was also entertaining.
Now, Mr. Maverick, they don't like that over here. What is the activated sludge process?
Well, I'm going to answer that question because I'm sure that nobody's going to know when I'm wrong.
I've got it.
I think there's something about the sewer system.
Do you have any sewage problem in San Antonio?
Well, now we have a politically...
never mind.
There is a lot of truth to Maverick's joke, Fisher said. As mayor, he worked to clean up a city that was known for being thoroughly politically corrupt, including the police chief, Owen Kilday. Kilday is remembered for his brutality, especially during the famous pecan sheller strike.
As Maury Maverick was being sworn in as mayor, and he had his right hand raised, as he lowered his hand, he pointed to Kilday and said, "You're fired."
Now, for what purpose, under a prudently and soundly administered municipal government, such as the ones we have in New York and in San Antonio, are long-term borrowings justified?
Long-term borrowings are only justified for permanent improvements, which must be paid over a long period of time.
You know
you must not have long-term borrowings for current obligations.
Very good. Very good. Now, you can rerun for mayor anytime you wish. Quite all right, Maverick.
Maverick did run for re-election, and he lost. Lewis said Maverick was branded a communist by his political enemies. After his tenure as mayor, Maverick continued to be involved in civic and political activities until his death on June 7, 1954. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can find past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org, and you can download and subscribe to us wherever you find cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.